Hi, everybody. My name is Hank Johnson, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's a pleasure to be here tonight to play to all my friends. And it's amazing how many people I know. 13 and a half years ago, if I would have seen somebody, I'd have crossed the street so you couldn't see me. And wonderful to see all of you. I drank for 30 years. I went into a bar when I was 18 years old, and they served me. And you're supposed to be 21 here in California, but I passed for 21. They served me my drink, and immediately I became a man. That's what I wanted to be, and I knew that I'm, you know, if you're a man, you can buy a drink over a bar. And they served me, so that's it. I never had to learn another thing for the rest of my life. I could play the jukebox over in the corner just as good as the rest of the guys. In fact, I thought my selection of songs were a little better than most. And I'd sit at the bar, look at myself in the mirror, and get better looking after the drink. And I just went back every opportunity I had from then on. And I met my wife in a bar. Where else do you meet girls? I don't know. And we got married, and we moved out to West Covina, a little house out there. Payments were $56 a month. And that included taxes and interest and the whole shop. And, you know, that first few months have come along, $56. You know, I had a hell of a time coming up with that money. I used my money to play for it, you see. And I said, well, I'll double up next month. The next month would come along, I'd have to come up with $112. Where am I going to get that money? And somehow I would get it and make the payment. And if anybody would have asked me, what's your problem? I would have said, money. Money is my problem. If I just had, how did I ever get involved in that kind of work that I'm doing? You know, it doesn't pay well enough. And if she would just go to work, or not be so extravagant, or something, you know. But money is my problem. When I married my wife, she had a little girl by a previous marriage, and we moved out to West Covina. And it turned out she was pregnant. And so I didn't start saving for that baby until about a week before it was due. I just couldn't come up with the money, so I went into the little town of El Monte and borrowed money from the beneficial finance company to pay for the doctor bill and the hospital medical expenses. And you know, when my son finally turned 25 years old, and I was finally sober on the program of AA, I finally got beneficial paid off. Now, it seemed like I always had a crisis in my life. I'd just about get to this guy paid off, and then something would happen. I'd have to consolidate my bill. And I thought I'd go borrow money. And sometimes I had beneficial Pacific Finance both going, and sometimes a bank loan, too. And all three, you know, and I total up all my bills at the end of the year for my income tax and the interest and all that. And I try to figure out, what in the hell have I purchased? What have I bought? You know, they don't finance $100 cars, I'll tell you that. the truth of the matter is I didn't buy anything. And I just paid out all these payments. And I finally figured it out after I got sober. It took me several years, but I finally figured it out. You know, I financed my booze. You know, I figure over a 30-year period, I probably paid an extra 20, 25 cents for every drink I ever took. I paid it to beneficial finance. And we almost lost that house, and we finally had to sell it and move in with my dad for free. And we moved a lot and had a lot of houses. And my drinking story is probably the most boring story you've ever heard in your life. I hear real exciting stuff from this podium. You know, guys go into a bar and they punch everybody out in a bar, and then five guys drag them out on the street and they punch them all out, and the police come and they, you know, and they fight the police and get thrown in jail, and they beat up all the prisoners in the cell and take the best bunk, you know. And, I heard, you know, this guy was speaking here, you know, that that he drove into tunnels 65 miles an hour and made U-turn, stuff like that. And my sponsor jumped over the Texas State Insane Asylum wall and ran through the Texas plains in his terry cloth robe and did all kinds of exciting stuff. And all I ever did is just sat around and drank. I played phonograph records, and I watched quite a bit of TV, and read a book once in a while. Reader's Digest, most of it, you know, condensed version, you know. And that's it. That's my drunk a lot. And my wife used to get excited about it, you know. She didn't like me drinking, so she kicked me out of the house. And I never knew why. I thought I was doing fine, you know. But she kicked me out. Whatever she said, I did. I never argued with her. And it never occurred to me to argue with her. I was so unworthy that I just left. If she said leave, I left. And I'd pack my two shopping bags and leave, you know. And I'd always move close by. I didn't get too far from home, you know. But moved down the street a little ways, and I worked my way back in and out, back and forth. And she divorced me 3 times. And the last time she divorced me, I finally got the idea. You know, you want to get rid of me? No problem. You can have the house. You can have the furniture. You can have everything. All I want is my stack of old 78 records. They're collector items, and I want that. And so I moved to Hermosa Beach, a little shack there on 4th Court, and it was just a half a block from the water, and it was a little house in back of a larger house, and this lady rented it to me. And actually what it was is kind of a one-room affair. It was like, oh, about 12 by 15 room, actually. And I bought a speaker, or that is, I bought a turntable and 10 speakers from a friend of mine. He was getting divorced, but he's smarter than I am. He kept some of the furniture. He was selling it off, and I bought this turntable and 10 speakers from him. And I had a speaker in all 4 corners, behind the drapes, behind the couch, you name it, in the bathroom, in the kitchen. Everywhere you looked, there was a speaker there, by God. And so a typical day for me was, I'd wake up late to work, you know, 10 o'clock, and I'd throw on my clothes real fast and get in that car, and I'd break the speed limit on the way to work and get there because, you see, I should have worked yesterday. I left all these papers all over my desk, and Jesus, the boss were to see them, why, he'd kind of get excited maybe about them. And God forbid if he looked in my desk drawer. I had papers in there. Some of them were months old. They were so old, they were too old to turn in. If I turned him in, I'd get fired. If I didn't turn him in, I was going to get fired. It was all going to happen today. I knew it. And I'd get there and I'd check everything out. Everything is the same as yesterday. Whew, man, you know, I'd get a cup of coffee and go back to my desk and sit there and shuffle papers and try to look interested and make excuses to my customers why they didn't get what they had ordered. And I'd tell them stuff like, well, you know, the class of help we buy nowadays, that we get nowadays, it's no wonder you didn't get it. I'll personally take care of it myself. I'll put it in the mail today. You can count on that. Or I'd blame it on the computer. That's a good one. You know, that's the best excuse in the world. Computer's been down for the last 6 or 7 days, and you didn't get that in the mail? Oh, well, I'll personally put that in the mail to you today. You can count on that. Now, if you don't hear from me in the next few days, call me again. Let's get this thing straightened out. And I'd make excuses like that for an hour or two, you know, till a respectable time to go to lunch. And then I'd go to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. And they sold martinis over there. And I like martinis. And during the lunch hour, they sold double martinis for $1. The regular martini was 75 cents, but during the lunch period there, he sold a double for $1. Who ever heard of having one martini, right? I'd say to myself, you're going to have two anyhow, so you might as well order the dollar one.
to save 50 cents. God knows you need the money, you know. And so I'd order this dollar martini, and I'd get the sipping on it, and I'd kind of check my drink against the guy sitting next to me, and he'd have a 75 center. And I'd say to myself, who the hell do they think they're kidding around here? This is no double. It's a little bit larger than the 75 center. If it was a double, they'd be charging more money for it. You know, I've been around. I know these things. You know, I don't know why I got took in with that. So I better have another one. And then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one. And then I'd call the office and tell them, I forgot to tell you, I'm going on a lot of calls this afternoon. Take messages. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I'd get in my car and I'd head towards the beach. And I'd stop at the Save-On Drug or the Thrifty Drug, and I'd buy the cheapest bottle of vodka they had there. You know, whatever was on sale that day. And I'd get home about 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon, and I'm a real neat drunk. I hang up my clothes real carefully, you know, in the hanger so that the creases fall properly, and put my shoes away and put my pajamas on. And I'd sit on the edge of the bed. I'd untap this cheap vodka and take a big jolt out of it. And I'd say to myself, well, done it again today. You know, done it again. You know, this cannot continue. You know, you're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why don't you do something about it? And I'd put an old record on the turntable. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, Who Can I Turn To? And then I'd go in, you know, then I'd start talking to myself. And I'd say, you know, you're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. For God's sake, why don't you do something? Most guys will get a second job. You know, they'll play catch up. Then I'd say, but I don't have to do that. I'm in sales. And if you're in sales, it all depends on how much you want to put into it, how much money you can earn. And so why don't you just apply yourself on that job? My God, what a terrific idea. That's it. That's the solution to my problem. And starting tomorrow, it's all going to be different. I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. I'm going to get down that damn office by 7. I'm going to knock out paperwork for a couple hours. And when that phone starts ringing tomorrow, I'm going to be ready to do business. And starting tomorrow, it's all going to be different. I'm going to devote my time, all my waking moments, selling. And I can go in there on Saturdays and do my paperwork. And hell, I got a key to the office. I can go in there on Sunday and plan my work for the coming week. You know. And if you're in sales, you know, if you plan your work and then work your plan, you can't miss. And I don't know about you guys, but when I make these terrific decisions like that, you know, I got room to celebrate. There's cause for celebration, so I have another drink. And I play another record. And then I get thinking a little more. And I figure out in my head, you know, if I do this, I'm going to triple my income. And in X amount of months, I'm going to be completely out of debt. What am I going to do with all that money coming in after that? Well, one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to buy a white Lincoln Continental car. And I'm going to drive it up to that house where she still lives. On the way up there, I'll stop at the Hallmark card shop and I'll buy this big, beautiful card. At least a dollar card. No cheapie, you know. Beautiful. With beautiful poetry on it. Over on the left-hand side, all right. Thanks for all the good years. H. You know, not Henry or Hank, just H. And I'll get a gold-plated key for this car. And I'll put it in with the card. And I'll drive that car up in front of the house like at midnight, you know, so I can make sure and get the proper parking spot right in front of the house. And then I'll tiptoe up on the porch and drop this card with the key down the mail chute there. And then I'll split. And the next morning, she'll wake up and she'll go through her routine.
and she'll check everything, and then she'll get her mail. She'll open her mail. Key, wonder what that key is, huh? Then she'll read this beautiful poetry, this beautiful, sad poetry. This makes tears roll down her cheeks. And then she'll see over on the left-hand side, thanks for all the good years, H. And then she'll look out front of the house, and she'll see this white Lincoln Continental out there, brand new, just shined, you know, this gorgeous car out there. And the key and the card and that automobile, she'll put it all together that that's her car. And then she won't think I'm so bad. You know, then she'll be sorry. And I don't know about you guys, but I get a lot of enjoyment out of giving those big gifts like that. And so I'd have another drink. And then I'd look at the clock again. It would be almost 11 o'clock at night. My God, where has this time gone? Where is this day gone anyhow? You know, it'd be like 10 minutes to 11. And I'd realize I'm almost out of booze. And I'd run to the liquor store about 2 blocks from where I live. That's when I first started jogging about that time. I had to get there before it closed. And I'd get the guy just as he was closing up and follow Smirnoff. I always bought the better brands there in the local area. I wouldn't want them to think I was cheap there in the neighborhood, you know. And then I could stroll back to my shack, and I'd have peace and content and security for the rest of the night. And I felt good. It hasn't been a wasted day after all. I've accomplished quite a bit. I got the plans for the rest of my life, you know, coming up. And then I'd get home, and I'd have dinner, cold hot dog out of the ice box. And then I'd sit down on the bed again, drink that vodka, spin these fantasies, you know. And I'd start rehearsing the speech I was going to give because I knew I was going to be salesman of the year. And somewhere in there, I'd pass out. And I'd wake up the next morning, it'd be 10 o'clock. I'm already an hour late to work. And geez, I'd throw my clothes on real fast and shave and get in that car and break the speed limit on the way to work. I knew by the time I got there I was going to be fired because, you see, I should have worked yesterday. And I left all these papers all over my desk. And if the boss were to see him, he'd just kind of get excited. And God forbid if he looked in my desk drawer, he was going to find papers in there. Some of them were months old. They were so old, they were too old to turn in. If I turned them in, I was going to be fired. If I didn't turn them in, I was going to be fired. It was all going to happen today. I knew it. And I'd get there, and I'd check my desk out. Everything's the same as yesterday. Whew, man. I'd get a cup of coffee and go back to my desk and shuffle papers and try to look interested and make excuses to my customers and use any excuse I could give, you know, like the computer one. I like that computer one. Every once in a while nowadays, I get a bill or something I don't agree with, and I'll call a company or a department store or something, and they tell me, some guy on the other end of the phone will say, "You know, the computer's been broke down for the last 6 days." And I wonder, you know, should I go into my 12-step talk, or, you know, who is this guy? But, you know, I'd make excuses, and then I'd go next door about 11:45. To the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked, and I'd make my big decision of the day over there, whether to have the dollar one or the 75-cent. And then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one. And then I'd call the office. I could have just hollered over there, you know, but I'd always call them on the phone. I'd make a lot of calls this afternoon, take messages. I'd be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, and I'd stop to save on it. And buy the cheapest bottle of vodka they had and get home about 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon and hang up my clothes and put my pajamas on and sit on the edge of the bed. And I'd say to myself, well, you've done it again today. Another wasted day. You know, this cannot continue. You're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Do something about it, why don't you? Most guys will get a second job, you know. You know, they'll pull themselves out of this thing, you know. Yeah, but I don't have to do that. I'm in sales. And if I just apply myself in sales, you know, and it's all going to be different starting tomorrow. I'm going to get up tomorrow, you know, and I'll devote the rest of this year playing catch-up. What the hell? I can You know, I can devote 1 year out of my life to get played catch up. God, you know, I didn't do that once or twice. I did that hundreds of times. Towards the end of the month, the boss say, "Are you in sales here?" And I, you know, and I'd say, "Yeah, I'm in sales." He says, "Well, how about making a sale?" And I'd say, "Don't worry about a thing. I'm a fast finisher." And I was, because I was running scared, and I'd work around the clock, and I always made my quota, and they always gave me a beautiful plaque at the end of each year, you know. And it, you know, big plaque, and it said, "For outstanding salesmanship and product knowledge, and it's being the type of representative, you know, that we want to represent our company," and all that. For 8 drunken years in a row, I won a plaque. And for 8 years, and then I got sober. And the next 8 years, I didn't win a plaque. And I was very disappointed. But in my sobriety, you know, a lot of guys make a lot of money after they sober up. And I was sure I was going to, but it just hasn't happened. You know, I've got a good job and doing okay, but I haven't made my $1 million. I'm a little disappointed, you know, but that's the way it is, I guess, with some of it. And in fact, after 2 years of sobriety, I went into the office one day, and the guy says, "You're fired." I said, "Fired? You can't fire me. I've worked for this 10 years now. I've been with the company. You can't, the hell, I can't fire you. You're fired." And I said, "Well, I'm going to go see the big man." And I went to downtown Los Angeles and saw the regional manager. And we talked. And I used to say that I took my fifth step with him. But actually what I did is I sniveled and cried. I told him, I said, "Geez, you know, I've been with this company 10 years now. And now the guy wants to fire me. I just don't understand. I got an outstanding sales record. And, you know, 2 years ago, I completely changed my life. I stopped drinking. And I'm trying to make it with my wife now and the kids, and I'm trying to pay off my bills and become a citizen in the community. And now the guy wants to fire me." Well, he says, "Congratulations. That's really very, very fine that you've changed your life and everything, but they just don't want you to work there in that office anymore. They don't want you there anymore." And so he said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put you on a short paid leave of absence because you claim to be a salesman. Go sell yourself to another branch office." And that's what I did. And I'm still with that firm. I'm a little worried because the last 3 or 4 years I've been winning plaques again. But after 2 years of sobriety, you know, I don't know, it happens, I guess, to a lot of us. I just got so spiritual that I just sailed way up into the sky. And I knew God was going to take care of me, right? I mean, we talk a lot about God around here, and he's going to take care of me, so I figured I didn't have to work, I guess. And my sponsor pointed out to me that I had that all wrong, you know, and he says, "But it happens to quite a few people." He says, "Some of us," he said, "just get so heavenly that we just become of no earthly good to anybody." And so that's what happened to me. And he pointed out in the book, it says, you know, that it's okay to have your head in the clouds, but you should keep your feet firmly planted on the ground and take these steps. And that's what I've been trying to do ever since. And but I've got ahead of my story. My wife, ex, called me up and said, "Come and get your drunken son, just like you are." And seemed like he had turned 16, and he was getting in little nickel and dime trouble at school. Nothing serious, you know, but just enough to drive her crazy. And he went out to a party one night and got drunk. Came home and got sick threw up on the carpet. That was it. That was the last straw. So she called me and said, "Come and get him, you know, just like you are." And I never argued with her. Whatever she said, I did. So I came and got him. And he didn't want it. You know, he didn't want to come and live with me, and I did not want him to come and live with me. And but she said, so we had to do this, you know. And you know, it's a funny thing. That was the start of a beautiful relationship that we've got going to this day. But he used to come and visit me sometimes. I didn't know what to say to a 16-year-old kid. What do you say to him, you know? If I wasn't drinking, I would say stuff like, you know, with your potential, that's a good one. Yeah. With your potential, you should be getting all A's in school. You know, with your physique, you should be out for football and be the captain of the football team. And, you know, you've got such good personality, you ought to be student body president. All the things that I kind of wish that I could have been when I was in school. And, or if I was drinking, which was most of the time, I'd slobber all over him. I'd tell him how much I loved you. You know, we love you. You know, your mother and I have had all this trouble over the years, but it has nothing to do with you. We love you. You know, you're no accident. You were planned. You're a love child, I told him. And he used to just sit there and cringe. He couldn't stand it, you know. And I'd just go on and on and on. I'd get him cornered, and he just wouldn't let him go, you know. And finally, next morning I'd wake up, I'd be ashamed of myself. Because I told my son I loved him. I couldn't even look him in the eye. I'd drive him home. He went home one time after spending a weekend with me, and he asked his mother, he says, "You've divorced him. Is there any kind of legal action I can take?" I don't want to go back there. But he had to. So that was the start of a beautiful relationship that we've got going to this day. We had something in common, you know, and when you have something in common to build from, then that's good, you know. And we had a resentment. Mom had kicked us both out, and we had that to build from, and we've got a good relationship going today. And it wasn't a month later or so, my wife moved in too. And here the three of us were in this one little place, you know, a little room, really. And it was a separate little house, and so we turned the garage part of the garage house into a bedroom, threw some tar paper down on old carpet and a bed, 50-watt bulb in the middle. Yeah, oh, the garage, and that was our bedroom. There we were. And she says, "I won't fight you on your drinking anymore. In fact, I'll join you." And little did I know, you know, that in my case, you know, I drank for a lot of years successfully. And I think I became allergic to alcohol. You know, I took penicillin a few times. And the last time I took penicillin, I wound up in the hospital for 8 days. I almost died. And the doctor told me, "You're allergic to penicillin. Don't ever take it again." And you know what? I've never taken it again. Boy, he scared me. If they had penicillin anonymous, I'd have about 30 years right now. I never had a desire to take penicillin again. But I think I drank myself, you know, into an alcohol addiction. And my wife, on the other hand, she was an alcoholic before she ever took her first drink. She was just like a stick of dynamite waiting to be lit, you know. And she could never drink successfully. She hated it, but she, you know, but she said she'd join me when she moved back in. And so then a typical day was that I'd get to work late and make my excuses and go next door and come home about 2 and put my pajamas on and sit on the bed and start spinning my fantasies. And here comes my son. And it's like 2:30 in the afternoon. And I'd say to him, you know, "Who the hell do you think you're kidding? It's 2:30 in the afternoon. School don't get out till 3. You're already home at 2:30. And I'd stand there with my pajamas. with a bottle of vodka in my hand, you know, and I'd say, and I'd ask him, you know, I'd ask him, how the hell do you ever expect to amount to anything? You know, if you apply yourself in this world, my son, you haven't got a chance. You need a diploma to get any kind of a job. I'm really worried about you. And he'd look at me funny. And they always had three or four guys with him, and they looked at me funny. We lived a half a block from the water, you know, and they kept their surfboards down there, too. That's one more thing we had to trip over. And it was, and then I'd start fantasizing about starting the Monarch. It's all going to be different. I'm going to devote the rest of this year, you know, on playing catch-up, and by God, this is it. And then my wife would come home, and we'd have our first drink of the day together. And, you know, if I'm not drinking, I'm not all that sociable of a person. In fact, I'm kind of antisocial. I just soon sit in the corner and read a book or watch TV or something. You can just do practically anything you want to do. Just go do it. Don't bother me. Don't ask me my opinion, and don't ask me for any money, and you're free. You can just do practically anything you want. But you give me one drink, and all that changes. And I don't care who you are, you're my favorite person. You're the most interesting person I have ever met in my entire life. I want to hear your life story from day one, and I'm prepared to sit up all night with you and to hear your plans for the future. As long as we got booze, I'm right there with you. My wife, on the other hand, is a very outgoing, friendly type person. She knows the paper boy by his name. She knows the girls at the supermarket, the checkout gals, and they all know her by name, and she knows them by name. I don't know how she knows so many people by name, but she's just one of those, you know, she's just an outgoing, friendly type. And but you give her one drink, and all that changes, and all the pent-up emotions and hostilities of a lifetime come out in this first drink, and she just gets meaner than hell. You know, she has a complete change of personality, and we could never drink successfully. You know, we used to just pass each other in the mouth. Just exchange personalities, you know. But she used to black out after the first drink, she said. She used to do a lot of bad stuff. And I'm not here to take her inventory, but she wasn't able to come with me tonight, and I just want to tell you guys a few of the things she did. Just so you'll help you understand me better, you know. It's not that I'm... But she did stuff like throw the Christmas tree, lights and all, out the back door. She used to break my old 78 records just because I played them more than once. Sometimes I'd get hung up on a song, and I'd play it, you know, and I'd play it again, and then again, and again, and again. Sometimes I'd get hung up on a trumpet tube, you know, and I'd get the needle, you know, and I'd just, and then it'd blow, oh, yeah, that's it. Yeah. And then it'd take me 5 more minutes to get it one more time, you know. And she used to listen to that and go crazy, and she'd go over to the phonograph and take the records and smash it. And I'd say, geez, don't break those are priceless 78s. You know, you can't get those songs. You can't buy those records anymore. Good, I never have to hear that again. She went over to the turntable and just took the arm and just bent it up. I couldn't play any more records that night, I'll tell you. There was a metal arm. I don't know where she got her strength from. The next morning, I got a wrench and pliers and hammer and tried to straighten that thing out. I couldn't get it straightened out. It cost $35 to get it fixed. And I finally told her, you know, this isn't working out again. But, you know, I allowed you to kick me out of all those other houses. But I want to tell you something. I moved here first. This is my house. This time you get out. And I'm going to go to my brother's house tonight, and stay overnight, and when I get back, I expect you gone. And so while I went to my brother's house, to my good brother's house, I got three of them. I got one that lives out here in Hammett somewhere. But he's getting pretty old now, and he's a bookaholic. You know, he's been reading all his life. You know, he just reads and studies life, you know. And boy, he's been studying it now for about 73 years, and one of these days he's going to get out there and try to live some of it. You know? But he sure knows about it, I'll tell you that. And then I've got my brother, my square brother, that you go to on Christmas Eve, and he's got a bottle up on the, you know, and you pull it down and untap it and pour you a drink, and you say, well, Merry Christmas, and you have a Merry Christmas drink, and then you put the cap back on, puts it back up on the shelf, and you come back next Christmas Eve, and you take the same bottle down, and he's completely square, he pays his bills on time, goes to work every day, and this is disgusting, you know? And then I got my good brother, the brother that you can go to at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, knock on his door, and he opens it up, and I got a bottle of vodka here. He'll pull you right in the door. You can sit up with him. He listens to you. You sit there and philosophize with him. And it seems like he picked the wrong girl, too. He was having some problems with his wife also. And we sat up all night and talked. And while I was gone, my wife decided to commit suicide. She was always trying to commit suicide. She was a failure at that. But this night, in fact, she was suicidal. You know, after she got on the program for a couple of years, she was still suicidal. She was going to commit suicide one time, and then she remembered she was the cookie lady at the meeting. So she had to postpone it, you know. And finally, her sponsor told her to knock that crap off, you know. So now she was sick here, real sick, in 1981, and now she wants to live. She really wants to live. And she's been working at that the last couple of years. When I came back, you know, well, she tried to commit suicide that night, but before she did, she went into the closet and took a knife and just slashed every stitch of clothes that I owned. Just ripped everything to shreds, you know, and even took the knife and stabbed my shoes. It just ruined everything, just made, you know, shambles out of everything. And then she took the rags that she had made and put them around the doors and the windows to try to make the place airtight. And she turned the gas on the kitchen stove. And she went to bed. And, you know, we lived half a block from the water. And that old place, the wind used to whistle through there. And you could have turned the gas on 10 ovens and never smelled it. You know. So she survived. The next morning she got up, she looked at all this stuff. She didn't remember, you know, and all this in a blackout, of course, and she could not believe what she had done. And then I got home, and I couldn't believe it either, I'll tell you that. And then my son came home, he thought we were moving again or something. And there we were, you know, and that's about it. That was about our bond. And you know, we both from good families. I'm from a good family. She's from a good family. We sure didn't plan this. But I hear an old guy speak every once in a while. He's been sober a long time. His name is Matt C. And he talks about, you know, that he had morals and scruples and he was taught them as a child. But the more he drank, the more he lost those. And they just went by the wayside. And he just drank them. You know, I really identified with that. Because that's what I did, you know. I had scruples and morals and everything, and I just drank every bit of goodness out of my life, and so did my wife. And there we were. And so About a month prior to that, we had gone back to group therapy again. You know, we went to group therapy off and on for 15 years or more, trying to figure out what was wrong with our marriage. And she always used to cop out to the people. There must have been 6 or 8 people in that group, and she'd tell them how much I drank. Why don't you tell them how much you drank? Why don't you tell them how you drank a fifth of vodka before I came home from work last night? Why don't you tell them how you finished the second fifth after you got home? We'd come out of those group sessions, you know, and my guts would just be on fire. I just hated those things. Could hardly wait to get a drink. And so this therapist asked me, he said, "Do you really drink as much as she says?" And I said, "Hell yes, I do. I drink. If you were married to a girl like that, you'd drink too. You know? If you had rotten kids like I've got, you'd drink too. I've got this pressure job. My God, the pressure's going to kill me on this job." And so I have a few drinks in the evening. What is the big deal, anyhow? Have you ever thought of quitting? I says, "Yes, I have. I had. Every night I thought about it. Starting tomorrow, not tonight." And he says, "Have you ever thought of going to AA? And I said, "Thanks, but no thanks. I've already been to AA." And I had been to a meeting prior to that. And it was one of these meetings where they get chips for various lengths of sobriety. And this leader said, "You know, it's a poker chip, and it says, one day at a time for 30 days or whatever." And so this leader says, "Anyone just completed the first 30 days? And here comes Joe. And here's your chip." "Oh, yeah, well, I'm really proud to get this chip. My name is Joe Blow. I'm an alcoholic, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful way of life. It's a spiritual way of life, and I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And the lights in the eyes of the people just turned me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. I just love everybody here. And just before I came to the meeting tonight, I got a call, and they made me general manager down at the plant. The best 30 days I've ever spent in my life. And I recommend all you newcomers, you know, keep coming back. It's a wonderful program. And I love everybody." And he sat down. I thought, "Oh, gosh." And then, "Anyone else just finished their, you know, first 30 days?" And here comes Mary. "My name is Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic. And I just want to tell you, this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. The lights in the eyes of the people here just turned me on and keep coming back to these meetings. And I just love everybody here. And when I see my children, they look at me with respect in their eyes. And my husband is looking at me with renewed interest." And what a glorious way to live. 12 wonderful steps. Oh, God. Who needs this? You know, I never went back, I'll tell you that. So when this therapist said, "You know, have you ever thought of joining AA?" I said, "Thanks, but no thanks. I've already been." And he said, "But I said, I've heard about some stuff called anabuse. And I think I'll get some of that." And, you know, anabuse, if you drink on top of it, according to this article I read, you get very ill. In fact, according to the article, if you drink on top of it, you could even kill. You know, you could even die. So I think I'll get some of that. Just in case I need a drink, you know, I'll pop one of those first, and then I won't, you know, I don't think I'll need it, but, you know. And he made an appointment with a doctor. This receptionist said, "Don't drink for 48 hours prior to the appointment, and have an appointment a week from next Tuesday," whenever it was. And, you know, I didn't drink for 48 hours prior to going on the appointment. I said, "I'm here for my interview." "Oh, yeah. And the doctor will see you in a minute." And he checked my heart and blood pressure, and he called me into his office, and he started talking to me about the disease of alcoholism. And, geez, I wasn't prepared for that, you know. He said, "If you haven't had a drink in the last 48 hours, you know, you don't need anabuse. In fact, if what you say is true, that you haven't had a drink for the last 48 hours, he said, you know, you need never take another drink as long as you live.
you know.
Well,
I just, you know, I wanted to quit, but that's a hell of a long time. You know? And I wasn't quite prepared to quit that long, you know. I just wanted to prove something to somebody. So then he went on and on and on about alcoholism and how people with the disease of alcoholism, they have character defects and they don't cope with their problems. And they put off coping, put off solving their problems. They get drunk tonight instead. And then the next morning they wake up and they've still got their problems, but now they've got a hangover too. And so he just, you know, I finally just went on and on. He started, he pulled a book out of his bookshelf and started reading how people try to enjoy and control their drinking by switching from scotch to brandy. And he did, and I know now what he read was a portion of chapter 3 to me. I thought he'd never stop, and I finally said, well, if you're not going to give me any abuse, then I guess I'd better go. How much do I owe you? And he says, I can see I'm not making much of an impression on you, but I'm going to tell you something. He says, I happen to know a little bit about alcoholism. He says, and due to the nature of this appointment today, I'm going to tell you. He says, my wife's an alcoholic. We've tried everything. He tried Retone, sanitariums, and psychiatry, and abuse, and you name it. We've tried it. Nothing's worked for her. But she's sober now. She goes to AA, and that's what I recommend that you do. And promise me one thing. Promise me that you'll go to the Manhattan Beach Clubhouse and buy the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and there'll be no charge for this call. And that's the only thing that guy said that day that pressed me at all. But I did go up and get the book, and I threw it on my dresser and had another drink and thought, geez, what a crazy doctor. You know, he could have had me come in there, you know, regular. He could have been making money from it. And he didn't even charge me. It's a crummy book, you know. But my wife had been with me and heard all this. And after this fiasco when she ripped up my clothes, she went back to him and she asked him if he thought she was an alcoholic. And he said, I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, but why don't you go to some meetings with my wife? She'd be happy to take you. And so she came home that night and she said, I'm going to go to AA with the doctor's wife. And I said, oh my God, what now? I agree you shouldn't drink. You know, some of us can drink, some of us can't, you can't. But you don't need AA. I told you about AA, some kind of a spiritual program or something. I don't know. It's a religious cult, I think, is what it is. And you don't need to go to that. And besides, what makes you think that the doctor's wife is going to drive down from Palisbury in her Cadillac and pick you up in the dump we live in? She said, well, I spoke with her this afternoon. She said she'd be coming by about 7:45. She's not coming in. She's just going to toot the horn. I said, good. I don't want her to come in. You know? And just remember what the name of this organization is. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. That means no name. Don't give them my name, whatever you do. We're not married anymore, I remember. You divorced me. And I don't want anybody knocking on my door. And besides, I just don't think she's going to show up. About 7:45, the Cadillac pulled up in front of this dump we lived in and tooted the horn. And off she went to a meeting with the doctor's wife. And the first thing they told her in AA was something that I just assumed they wouldn't have told her right off the bat. They said that it wasn't her fault that I drank. Just all the things to start her off with. I had her half convinced that, you know, it was her fault that I drank. But they said, no, don't carry that guilt around. There's no way you can make anybody drink if they don't want to drink. You don't have that kind of power over anybody that you can make them drink. So don't carry that guilt. And they also told her that you can't make him quit either. And don't even bother trying. Don't pour his booze down the drain. You know, he'll just go buy some more. But if you think you've got a problem with alcohol, why don't you come back to these meetings and work on your problem, and just let that SOB drink himself to death. If that's what he wants to do, it's his life. She kind of liked the ring of that.
And so she started going to meetings, and to be a good guy, I'd go to a meeting once in a while with her. And it just seemed like those two people were at every meeting I went to, you know. And Joe was just doing marvelous, you know. I mean, Joe, I'm an alcoholic, and I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And the lights and the eyes of people just turned me on, keep me coming back to these meetings. I love everybody here. Just before the meeting, just before I came tonight, I got a call from the boss, and they made me a full partner down at the plant, you know. And isn't it wonderful? And I'm taking delivery on my Mercedes in the morning, and I just can't get over how wonderful of a life this is, and I recommend it for everybody. God, I hated that guy, you know. And I know how wonderful it is not to drink. You know, they don't have to tell me how good it is. I've been sober a few times before. I know how good you feel after 30 days. And, you know, but the hypocrite. And then Mary Smith, by now, she's got a halo. She's so pure. My name is Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful, glorious way of life. And I walked in the door hand in hand with God, and I just love everybody here. And isn't it a wonderful, glorious life? And when I see my children, you know, I'm proud to say that just 90 short days ago when I quit drinking, my children were failing in school. Now they're on the honor society. Just because I quit drinking, it's just, you know, it just improves family life. And I'm proud to say that my husband and I are a couple once again. How glorious. And I just said, then we all stood up and said the Lord's Prayer and held hands. How hokey can you get? And after the meeting, you know, you think you could get out of there? No, there's another meeting going on right immediately following the meeting. You know, that's where they all congregate. And they all used to come up to me, and these ladies just come up and say, "Are you Lou's husband?" And I'd say, "Yes, I'm Lou's husband." "Well, are you an alcoholic too?" And I say, "No, I'm not an alcoholic too. I'm a visitor here. You know, she's one. Work on her." I finally found out that I was an alcoholic. And I told her that I'm an alcoholic, and I realized it, but I'm not going to these meetings. I cannot stand to go to these meetings and listen to these people. They're all saying the same thing, and you know, I can't believe them. So I think I'm gonna quit on my own. And I quit a little bit before Thanksgiving, and I stayed sober, didn't drink clear through Christmas. I remembered my Christmas presents and everything. And I wasn't all that pleasant to be around, I'm sure, but by God, I wasn't drinking. And the Saturday night after Christmas, my wife went to a meeting, and I stayed home, and I got to talking to myself, and, you know, I proved that I can handle it. You know, geez, I stayed sober since before Thanksgiving, clear through Christmas. That proves I don't have to have it. So I went out to the liquor store and bought a half a pint of vodka. And I no sooner got it back to the place, what did I buy a half pint for? I went and got a fifth. I went back and got another fifth. And I drank all Saturday night and all day Sunday up to 2 a.m. Monday morning. Closed the bar. And next morning, woke up 10 o'clock. I'm already in late to work. And I threw my clothes on real fast and shaved and got in that car and broke the speed limit on the way to work. I knew by the time I got there I was going to be fired because I left all these papers all over my desk. And I knew it. Today is the day, you know. And I got there, checked everything out. Everything's the same as yesterday. I got a cup of coffee and shoveled papers. And I went over and I was so sick after not having alcohol in my system for a little over a month and then pouring all that in. You know, I was deathly ill. So I went to the bar a little earlier that day, and I ordered a Bloody Mary. You know, that's what you order when you're sick. That's not a social drink or anything. That's medicine is what it is. And I ordered a glass of medicine. And the guy got a big tall glass and put shaved ice in it, put a shot of vodka, tomato juice, and Tabasco, and and Worcestershire sauce, and he squeezed a lime, and he put some salt, and he stirred it. I thought he'd never get the damn thing made. And I finally got it made, and I took it up, and I drank it straight down. Blurped it all over myself. Nuts. And I said, make me another one. I went to the restroom, and when I came back, he said, did you want a Bloody Mary, another Bloody Mary, or did you want a martini? And I said, I just skipped. And I went over to the coffee shop section of the bar, and I had a sandwich and a glass of milk, and I haven't had a drink since. You know, and of all days to quit. You know, that wasn't the day. I hadn't even thought about it the night before or anything. I didn't know that was my last drink. In fact, I've often thought, you know, if I would have known that that was my last drink, you know, I wouldn't have had a Bloody Mary, I'll tell you that. I'd have had something in a flat, fancy glass, like brandy in a beautiful brandy snifter, you know, or at least a martini or a champagne cocktail or something, you know, and I would have drank it and smashed that glass. And stomped out of the bar, triumphant over alcohol. Yeah. But I didn't know it. I didn't know it was my last drink. And a couple of weeks went by, you know, and I was in kind of a twilight zone there. I didn't know. A couple of weeks went by, and I realized, gee, you know, I haven't had a drink in over 2 weeks. And then anger set in. You know, I had just completed 30 years of drinking. I got this rotten wife. I got two of the worst kids you could possibly imagine. This pressure job, my God, the pressure is just going to kill me. And I owe everybody money, and it's all past due. And, you know, if somebody knocks on the door, I know it's the police. I don't know what I've done, but I'm ready to go. And I'm guilty. I know that. And now I can't even drink. It's taking that away. What am I going to do with the rest of my life? Nothing. That's what I'm going to do. There's nothing to do. What can you do? You can't even go to a decent restaurant ever. Because if you go into a nice restaurant, what's the first thing they ask you? First thing they ask you is, would you like a drink before dinner? And you can't say, well, yeah, I'd like one, but you see, you know, I've got this disease. And it's of a two-fold nature. It's an allergy of the body, and it's coupled with an obsession of the mind. And if I even take one drink, I can't predict my behavior. And if it wasn't for that, I'd sure have one, you know. I used to think you had to explain all that stuff to people. In fact, if I was standing on a street corner and somebody walked up, I'd start explaining to them what I was doing there. I just had that need to explain. That's one of the freedoms that I've gotten in AA. I don't have to explain near as much as I used to. And everything that I knew for sure, it turned out to be wrong. I went to a nice restaurant just recently, and the waitress came up and said, "Would you like a cocktail before dinner?" And I said, "No, thanks." And you know what? Didn't even phase her. She just went to the next table and asked them. And they did. They always do. I always check, and they always do. I'm the only guy in the whole place not drinking. It's all right. But you know, the cruelest thing I've learned in my whole entire life is they don't give a damn out there whether you drink or not. That was one of them. Gee, that was one of the things that I was really worried about when I came to AA. What are they going to say? They find out I don't drink. Well, they don't give a damn. We care here. We make a big deal out of it. You get candles, you know. Grown men and women get up and blow candles out in front of 200 people. You know, it's ridiculous. Until you take one yourself, of course. But we care here. But they don't care out there. And if they don't, you know, I went to work early. One Monday morning I came to work, and my boss walked in and said, "Hi, Hank." Just went into his office. You know, if he would have known the trouble I had, what I've gone through, you know, to get there at 8:45 on time on a Monday morning, it would have been more than High Hank, I'll tell you that. But they just don't care out there. And I could never, you know, I just, well, Jesus, getting late here, and I'll bring you up to date. My wife and I are both sober 13 and a half years. But you know what? I'm sober longer than she is. How could that possibly be? She went to AA before me. Well, she didn't hear the part about the pills. They don't want you to take these pills or smoke funny cigarettes, these. And she thought they were talking about the kind of pills that you smuggle in from Mexico in your hubcaps or something. Not prescription Librium. Yeah, her sponsor said, yeah, prescription Librium too. 29th, 1969, I hope. And she flushed her pills down the toilet January the 1st, 1970. If you'll notice, there's a whole year difference. I've got time on her. You know, I'm senior in my household. I got more. She's a newcomer, and she's got to get coffee. I say coffee, and she brings it, you know, because she's a newcomer. And this kid, this boy of mine, you know, no wonder he was looking at me so funny. Turned out he was stoned out of his gourd. Seemed like he had a problem, too, with alcohol and pills and marijuana and LSD and you name it, he's taken. And I'll be damned if he didn't turn himself into AA when he was 21. Next month in May, he's coming up for a 10-year case. And our daughter sends you greetings from Al-Anon. And we're an AA family. And I don't want to intimate that we're the best family on the block, but we are a family, and we have our problems, and we've got plenty of them. You know, my son, he's a very successful young businessman. I thought he'd never be able to get a job. He makes twice as much money as I do. He's got his own condo in San Fernando Valley. A little over a year ago, he married a beautiful little Al-Anon girl. And I just resent the hell out of it. Well, he never had to suffer near as much as I did. I tried it pretty nice. I tried to, you know, get on the good side of him. He just took delivery on an 83 BMW car, and I figure if I treat him real nice, maybe he'll let me use his car sometime. And he was a young people's speaker in Palm Springs 4 or 5 years ago. And he got up on the stage, and, you know, it's a big deal. There's like 2,000 people sitting out there in the audience. My wife and I were out there, and the first time I ever seen him dressed up. Suit, you know, just beautiful new suit, and his hairstyle, coat, you know, nice coat, tie, and shoes shine, really looking good. And sit up there at the podium in front of all these people. My wife and I were out there, and he said, "My name is Matt Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. I also use drugs." He said, "I'm the son of a drunken mother and a drunken father." My wife and I looked at each other, you know, and just burst into tears. We were so damn proud. And, you know, I've taken all these steps. I've tried to take them, you know, with no sincerity at all. I knew they wouldn't work for me. Hell, I've been in therapy all these years, you know. And I'll be damned if I haven't had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, just as if I'd have been sincere. And I haven't learned all that much, but there's a couple of things I'd like to report to you. You know, when I see my children now, they look at me with respect in their eyes. My wife and I, I'm proud to announce, are a couple once again. I found out that this is a spiritual program, that I found God when I walked through the door. And the lights in the eyes of the people here turn me on and keep me coming back. Thank you very much.